Hello. For those of you who don't know me, my name is David Lane. I operate a sports medicine specialty referral practice in Squamish, BC, just north of Vancouver. And today I'm just going to review the abstracts from the 2017 Veterinary Orthopedic Society Annual Conference. So before I start, I'll just mention there was a paper published, I think like 2 years ago, that looked at these abstracts and then looked at the final papers that came out and compared them. And they did find that there generally were changes between the abstracts and the final paper, and that the longer the distance between when the abstract was published and the final paper was published, the more those changes were. So I'm just mentioning that because the peer-reviewed abstracts aren't the same as peer-reviewed final papers, and I think they're good for sort of basic walkaway messages, but you don't want to get too mired down in the details. So I'm just going to go over the what I found were the interesting abstracts, the relevant ones, and just try and summarize them. So the first one was called The Effects of Administration of Adipose-Derived Stromal Vascular Fraction with Platelet-Rich Plasma to Dogs with Osteoarthritis of the Hip Joints. And I found this one interesting because we've got a lot of studies with some sort of stem cell component, usually stromal vascular fraction, in isolation, or we've got studies with PRP in isolation. But there's good reason to think that PRP and stem cells work better in combination, that they have a synergistic effect. And so this was the first study that I'm aware of that to look at the combination of the product as a treatment for osteoarthritis. Now, unfortunately, they didn't compare PRP versus stem cells versus the combo. They just sort of were interested in demonstrating that the combo works. It was supplied by Medivet Biologics. So that was the system that was used. And so basically, they took 22 client-owned dogs, and they gave simultaneous IV and intra-articular injections of the SVF and PRP, and then the control group got a placebo, and they looked at these dogs at 0, 4, 8, 12, and 24 weeks after injection. They used subjective owner outcome measures, the chronic brief pain inventory score, so just how the owners thought they were doing. And they also had a pressure mat that they looked at pre-critical force, and they basically found that, yep, it worked. The owner scores showed improvement relative to the controls, and they actually took the bottom 25 percentile, so the dogs whose values on the pressure mat had were the worst, and like the bottom quarter, and compared that against the controls, and the bottom quarter of the group that had received the actual PRP SVF still did better than the control group. And so that was done to 24 weeks out. Be nice to see a longer term study. Again, I'd like to see a comparison, but there we go. So one's called Meniscal Kinematics Through Automatic 3D Meniscus Model Extraction from MR Images, Validation Application in Clinical Stifles, which is probably numbing. The reason I include this one is it was just interesting to know how much the meniscus moves. So it was a cadaveric study. They took 16 dogs. They didn't say the size of the dogs, which I'd like to know, and measured the meniscal displacement at different weight-bearing knee positions. And they found that the menisci moved between 13 and 14 millimeters. The medial cranial horn and the lateral caudal horn were the ones that were the most mobile, and if you just looked at those locations, they moved about 16 millimeters, 15 to 16. So I just didn't realize, crap, they really slide around in there that much. So this one was called the Comparison of Tibial Morphology in Normal and Cranial Cruciate Ligament Deficient Stifles of 18 dogs. So basically, they took CT images of the tibial plateau and looked for confirmation qualities that would allow to predict who was going to get cruciate disease. So they did a bunch of studies and, you know, basically found that if you had a wider tibial plateau or larger medial subchondral surface, that correlates with likelihood of blowing the cruciate. The thing I want to draw attention to is they did look at TPA. And this matches other studies where, although we know the tibial plateau angle, the steeper it is, the more force is on that cruciate ligament, and that's, you know, the whole point of doing a TPLO or, you know, TTA is to change that morphology of the joint. it wasn't an active predictor of who was going to blow their cruise sheet or not. So you can't look at those deep plateaus and automatically draw a correlation. There are apparently other measurements that do have a correlation. This is probably mostly just a research thing, but it's worth noting that you just can't look at a steep slope and say, oh yeah, they're going to blow their cruchet. And you know, we look at the small dogs, they have these ridiculously steep slopes, and a lot of them just don't blow their cruchets. There are other factors at play. So this one's called Measurement of Shoulder Abduction Angles in Dogs, an Ex Vivo Study of Accuracy and Precision. I think this one is now a full paper. So basically, it looked at shoulder abduction angles with three observers in 10 medium to large size cadavers, and then they did arthroscopy and cut the medial glenohumeral ligaments and subscapularis tendon, and then measured these abduction angles. And they looked at what the different observers got. They did fluoroscopic imaging and made measurements, and they looked at the intra and inter-observer error and found that there was poor inter and inter-observer repeatability. So between different people measuring the angles, there was poor correlation, and then with the same person doing it repeatedly, there was also inaccuracies, and then there was also inaccuracies when these abduction angles were compared with the fluoroscopic measurements. And it was for all three observers. So basically, and I know there's at least one other study that came to the same conclusion, it's just you can't use the abduction angle as your sole criterion for diagnosing MSI. It's going to lead to problems if you do that. It's got to be coupled with other criterion. The gold standard is some form of arthroscopy. We're getting in there to take a look at it. High field MRI could be useful. You got to watch out. There's a lot of low field MRI machines out there. They're less expensive, which is why they're more popular, but the resolution's not as good. So if we're dealing with a relatively small dog, there's some concern about imaging quality, whether it's going to give you your answer or not. Ultrasound, you just can't reliably visualize that medial compartment. And you know, some of the gurus say they can. I think most say that you just can't do it consistently. Got interrupted there. So I think I was about to say that when I approach these cases, I often find, you know, scoping and MRI are both expensive and not a great way to do a initial workup from a client's point of view. So I generally do the abduction angle with Enfeel combined with ultrasound imaging, and although we can't see the medial compartment directly, if I've got evidence of inflammation in the absence of another cause for that inflammation combined with the abduction angle results, especially when they're dramatic and greater than 10 degrees between left to right, then I use that as enough for a presumptive diagnosis. And so far, I think I've done well by that as a diagnostic criterion, for whatever that's worth. The next one's called the Association of Postoperative Rehabilitation with Outcome in Dogs with Intervertebral Disc Herniation. So this was looking at an in-house rehabilitation program for dogs that had laminectomies. So they looked at all dogs that were non-ambulatory, and they measured return to walking and the timing it took to turn to walking and complication rates. The bottom line is they found that significantly more dogs returned to full neurologic function in the rehab group at 33% compared to the control group, which happened at 9%. They also found the complication rate was significantly higher in the control group at 29% compared to the rehab group at 16%. The other conclusion was that they stated that the median time to return to normal conscious proprioception and median time to ambulation were shorter in the control group than the rehab group. So a little confused by that, because they're saying success rates higher with rehab, complication rates lower with rehab, but return to function was longer with rehab. So that, I think, is going to take a full paper to dissect what's going on there. This one's called A Comparison of Sham versus Actual Low-Level Light Therapy and Treatment of Canine Elbow Osteoarthritis, Pain, and Lameness. So this one basically looked at laser therapy in 20 dogs with naturally occurring elbow arthritis. So, the abstract didn't really give much information on methodology, which is important. One of the authors was Janice Huntingford, another Canadian, so I reached out to her. And, yeah, she said the final article was published in the CVJ, the Canadian Vet Journal. She thought it was, like, September 2018. So that will have the full detail. But the bottom line is they had 11 dogs in the treatment group, 9 in the sham group, and they treated with laser therapy at 10 to 20 centimeters per squared per joint for 6 weeks. I don't know how frequent, and I don't know any of the other details. That's the only methodology I've got. But it was successful improving lameness scores and owner perceived pain scores and allowing for the reduction of NSAID dose in canine patients with elbow osteoarthritis. So for all of those out there that are sitting on the ledge and whether they want to do laser or not, there's just more evidence to do it. So this one's called Preclinical Evaluation of a 117 MSN Colloid as a Radiosynovial Arthesis Agent for the Treatment of Canine Elbow Joint Osteoarthrosis. So this one was new on me. So I guess it's a human thing where they inject a radioactive particle into the joint, and then that particle gets phagocytized into the synovium where it exerts its radioactive effect and fries the synovium. And so they find that you, when they go back in histologically, you get absence of the villus and a lot more fibrosis. So I guess think hyperthyroid treatment for the joint capsule wall, basically. And so they're doing this as a pain modality in people, and so they looked at it in dogs. So they did 5 dogs, and it wasn't to look at the effectiveness of how it worked, but they injected the dogs with this stuff, and then greater than 99.8% of it was stayed in the joint, and there's no adverse effects. It was well contained. The radiation dose of the whole body, major organs, was minimal. So at this point, they're concluding that this is a safe modality. And I'm assuming the next phase of this will be, does it work? But maybe that's something else that's coming down the pipe for dogs. Here's another one. Pancarpal arthrodesis using hybrid dynamic compression plates without external coaptation. So I've seen other papers in this topic as well. Like, traditionally, when you're doing pancarpal arthrodesis, it always says you need to splint them afterwards, but it's already a surgery with a high complication rate, and many of those complications can be splint-related, you know, decubital ulcers, etc. And so there's this debate, and one paper found that, hey, you know, our complication rate wasn't particularly bad by not splinting them. So this is another research paper looking at that, and basically they used only a light bandage to control swelling during the immediate postoperative period. And then they looked at complication rates and concluded that you may not necessarily need a splint afterwards, that the findings supported that idea. So just something to think about if you've got one of these cases and now you've got a, you know, even if the surgeon wanted a splint on, but you've got really bad splint complications. Of course, obviously, you can't change the plan without talking to the surgeon if you weren't the surgeon, but there's a reason to maybe breathe a sigh of relief that you don't necessarily need that splint. This one's called The Effect of Carprofen Usage on Platelet Activation and Canine Platelet-Rich Plasma. So there's a whole issue with both platelets and stem cells that if you give it and you're meant to engender to a certain degree an inflammatory response to kickstart the healing process, if you give NSAIDs at the same time, are you going to blunt the effectiveness? And so this paper looked at platelet activation for dogs, both on and off carprofen. And so one of the groups, they just did normal PRP. The other, that they activated the platelets with a human gamma thrombin. And they found that fewer than 5% of platelets were positive for the CD62P expression that they were looking at in the regular group, but up to 100% in the ones that were activated. But carprofen didn't have an effect either way on the platelet activation. So basically, more evidence to suggest that we don't have to worry about giving NSAIDs at the time of PRP and blunting the effectiveness. If the dog's comfortable, I've been staying away from it, but there have been plenty of times where, A, the dog was uncomfortable post-injection, and so I wanted to do something for pain. And fairly often, I'm giving it in the knees at the time of cruciate surgery, and they're all on NSAIDs at that point, and I still find it works like a hot damn. So my subjective experience was it's not contraindicated for PRP. Still don't know about stem cells, though. So there's an abstract on allogeneic stem cell survival and localization after intra-articular administration in laboratory beagles. So we're looking at allogeneic stem cells here. So, you know, most of the time, these stem cell products are autologous. They're something we've pulled from the dog's body. But there are companies out there manufacturing these allogeneic universal donor stem cells with the goal that eventually you can just have your own little liquid nitrogen tank with vials of stem cells in it, and once you need it for a case, you just pop it out, put it into a modified toaster, and then turn around and inject it to the dog, and you know, it just simplifies the process. So basically, this was a study that looked to make sure, like, if we do inject allogeneic stem cells into the joint, do they stay in the joint? And they found that they found evidence of it being engrafted in the cartilage 60 days out, and no evidence of systemic distribution. So it seems like it sits in the joint, and that's consistent with previous research on autologous stem cells. So kinetic gait analysis of agility dogs entering the A-frame. This one I know has become a full paper. So it's to investigate the effect of a decrease in the inclination angle of the A-frame, so just lowering the apex height on the A-frame, on the peak vertical force of agility dogs hitting it. So they put the A-frame at different heights and then had a bunch of trained border collies hit it, and they like put a force plate on the contact area. And the bottom line is they found a decrease of the angle of the A-frame didn't result in lower peak vertical force and some of the other forces that they measured. And they're saying, like, we don't really know if the peak vertical force relates to A-frame injury or not, but at the very least, lowering the height of the A-frame doesn't seem to make a difference, was their initial conclusion, which I think it's great that we've got this, and this is a starting place. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. You know, they didn't look at shearing forces on the, you know, which would affect the digits. And we also didn't look at the kinematics, like the angle at different angles to dogs engage their forelimbs differently at the time of contact. And this is a discussion in the agility community. Some agility, depending on which organization you're competing in, for the A-frame, some require the dog to hit the up contact as well as the down contact, and others aren't concerned with the up contact. And handlers of larger dogs are unhappy hitting the up contact because they see the angle that their dog needs to have in those forelimbs when they hit that up contact, and they're not in the best shock absorption position just because they're too big and the contact is too low to the ground. They feel that their dog is much less at risk for an injury if they're allowed to pick their own height. So, again, the A-frame's been identified by owners as being a cause of injury, and again, that's owner observation, so we can question the validity of that observation. It hasn't really been verified, but you know, these are things worth looking at, but I think it's a lot more complicated than just what's the peak vertical force at the time of contact. But here's a place to start. So there's looking at the incidence of radiographic patellar tendon thickening following tibial leveling osteotomy using three methods of joint inspection. I found this one a little confusing because they had an acronym CA, and then they didn't define what CA means elsewhere in the paper, so I don't know what they're talking about with that. But the bottom line was they looked at arthrotomy versus scoping and different locations for the scope portals, and looked at, does that contribute to the likelihood of getting patellar tendon thickening? And they did find that the joint approach does influence the development of patellar tendon thickening following a TPLO. And then for those cases where that thickened tendon does progress to desmitis and an actual source of discomfort, then that may be a variable. So I've talked for 20 minutes, and that's long enough for anyone, so maybe I'll just cut it here, and then we'll do a part two.